This is the Mary Hyken Dumont Jewish University here at ASBE, and our focus is four lenses on the Bible that each commentator, I believe, has their own glasses and their own lenses through which they see the Bible. And last week, we claimed that Rashi was looking mostly through the lens of meaning. He was trying to find personal and communal meaning in the text, and that was his greatest motivation in writing the commentary, even though he says that he's here to interpret the pshat, the simple meaning of the text. But we said that no, he's actually interested in preaching and sharing messages that he thought would be valuable, and that's really his legacy, and that's why he's so popular. This week we turn to a different commentator from a different community. Today France and Spain are just a hop and a skip from each other, but then totally different worlds. The Spain of Andalusia, southern Spain from which Ibn Ezra emanates, he's a little bit younger, about 40 years younger than, 40, 50 years younger than Rashi, but they overlapped in their lifetime. In southern Spain, the whole focus is grammar. It's a very grand Spanish sense. They lived, actually, this is Muslim Spain in those days. And so there's a tremendous focus on grammar and language. One of his activities was he was a tremendous poet. We read a lot of his poetry. Almost all the rabbis in those days in different communities wrote poetry. But Ibn Ezra is particularly beloved. There's one that some people say on Friday night, a song of Tzama Nafshi Elokim, my soul thirsts for God. And some say that he had the Holy Spirit when he wrote that, because it was such a beautiful song. Usually we don't associate the Holy Spirit with Ibn Ezra because he's a bit of a cynic. We'll see, he has some radical ideas. He's not a Talmudic rabbi. I don't know if you really call him rabbi, because he's not Talmudically trained per se. Almost all other Talmudic commentary, all other biblical commentaries that you find, Rashi, Nachmanides, they're giants in Talmud as well, and this is sort of their side activity. But in Ibn Ezra's case, this is a major activity, writing a commentary to the Bible. I must say from the outset that Rashi is a much smoother writer, and that Ibn Ezra, although he's a great poet, in his commentary, it's a little bit clunky. You have to understand that everyone who was writing in those days was groping in the dark for the right Hebrew to use, because there wasn't really the full vocabulary that was needed, and they were developing it on the fly. Okay, so since we learned about Rashi last time, in order to introduce ourselves to Ibn Ezra, I thought we would look at Ibn Ezra's relationship with Rashi. You would think that he would, since Rashi's commentary preceded his, he would always sort of play off Rashi, but the sense is that only sometimes he's commenting off of Rashi. There's a list of about 15, 20 times that he actually cites him or quotes him. But you don't have a feeling in general that his whole commentary is made to counter him. Next week we'll meet the Ramban, who very much felt like, well, Ibn Ezra and Rashi already said what they said, and my job is to go a step further. But here, he's starting sort of from scratch. But I'd like to take a few cases where Rashi and Ibn Ezra do disagree, and Ibn Ezra takes Rashi to task, as I said, as the junior partner. And let's see what this tells us about the Ibn Ezra, and then we'll get toward that question of what is the lens of truth, what do I mean by that, and what is that all about? Okay, so we begin a story in Genesis, Vayishlach. Now this week's parsha of the one after that, where Yaakov is afraid of Esav coming, so he takes certain precautions. So Jacob is thinking, if Esav comes with one camp and attacks it, the other camp will escape. I'll divide my family and my slaves and my property into two camps, and that way if he attacks one camp, the other one can run away in the meantime. Now, and then one camp will be left as an escape, or will be a refuge. Platim, the DP camps were called Machanot Platim. The displaced person camps were called Machanot Platim. People were left over, survivor. So the left, there'll be one camp that will survive. So let's look at Rashi and then Ibn Ezra. Who would like to read the Rashi for us? Then the remaining camp may escape. Lenny, would you?
Then the remaining camp may escape and fight him. I will fight against him. He prepared himself with three things. to give him a present as he says in Genesis 19:22. So the present says the Lord, the prayer, as it states in Genesis 19:10. And he said, "O God, I have given him reward," as it states in this verse, "for the remaining camp may escape."
Okay.
So Rashi citing the Midrash Tanhuma, citing earlier sources, citing the rabbinic sources, says that he prepared himself for three things. He prepared himself in battle. It's a battle plan. We attack from this camp, the other camp will escape. He's also going to propitiate. He's going to pray. He's going to throw himself on the floor. He's going to give a gift to the enemy brother, and he's also going to pray to God. So he takes these three pronged approach. So that's a midrash. But he claims that when one camp will be left over, so it's hard to know what Rashi means. He says, perforce. In other words, in spite of him, he says, I would translate perforce, that he will definitely have one camp left over. Ibn Ezra suspects that that's a pietistic statement, that Rashi believes that, well, surely I'll have one camp left over. You know? So, now, we're trying to determine the simple meaning of the text. So you say, well, here's a fellow who's very afraid of his much stronger brother, much more capable from a physical point of view, much more capable brother, coming with 400 men to attack him. And he's just a bunch of kids and farmers and shepherds. So what are we going to do? But Rashi says, no, perforce, there will definitely be one camp left. So the Ibn Ezra says, that's not the simple meaning. It's not the simple meaning. You think because you're reading the Midrash that he's going to have a prayer and all that, and you're such a pious man, you think that he knows that there'll definitely be one camp left. He says, I don't think so. So let's take a look at Ibn Ezra. Who would like to read that? Joe, would you read it for us?
Yeah. "And the remaining camp can remain. Perhaps it'll be the case that they will run away. Or his brother's anger will abate with his attack on the first camp. Or reprieve and rescue will come from God. And similarly, if the Aramaeans prove too strong for me, you come to my aid."
Yes, so this may relate to Ibn Ezra's theory about Arabic and Hebrew. Ibn Ezra lives among Arabs and who had taken over part of Spain. And so he's very, very, very familiar with Arabic. And apparently there's a pay in Arabic which means "and then." So he thinks that the vav, the "and," in this word, in this phrase, "and the remaining camp will be left over," means and then you know, hopefully there'll be a camp left over, and hopefully then there'll be a camp left over. But it's not necessarily so. Maybe God will save me. Maybe his brother's anger will abate. Maybe he'll rescue. Maybe reprieve and rescue will come from God. He's not sure. However, what does Rashi say? And that which
Rav Shlomo Rashi.
Notice, so we call him Rashi. In his day, he just calls him Rav Shlomo. Among his grandchildren, he's very much known as Rashi. But for the Ibn Ezra, he's just Rabbi Shlomo. Okay. Go ahead.
"That he would be a remnant by force as a way of drash, midrash."
So firstly, he dismisses Rashi by saying that's midrash. We, the Ibn Ezra, Rashi, we're trying to give the simple meaning of the text. Don't tell me the Midrash. If the Midrash is a simple meaning, fine. But this is just pure Midrash.
But why, though? I don't really understand, you know, why it's not a simple meaning. I don't really get it.
I think he senses that it's a very fine point here. And a lot of the messages I was trying to portray tonight are difficult. It's difficult. He's intentionally cryptic. Just like the Rambam when he wrote his Guide to the Reflex, when he writes his general writings, kind of hides some of his ideas. There are some radical ideas in the Ibn Ezra, and he hides. I believe that in this case, he senses and smells a pietistic reading. That since we all know that Jacob survives, and since we all know that God protects the Jews, so therefore, surely the meaning is, and surely I will survive. But we know that Jacob is deeply distressed. He's worried. Who says he's necessarily going to survive? He says, perforce. Rashi is saying, I will definitely survive.
But Rashi is saying that about the Parsha.
Rashi is saying about the Parsha.
Jacob says, surely I will
survive. Surely I'll survive. So, comes Ibn Ezra and says, how do you know that? That's just Midrash. The idea that a man who's deeply worried feels guaranteed that he'll survive, that's Midrash.
Why would he pray?
Why is he praying if he knows for sure? So we're getting into the question, when a holy man, a prophet, is worried, how worried is he? Can a prophet be truly worried? Or does a prophet always know, well, I'm the child of Abraham, and I have a blessing, and everything will be fine? How does it work? Are these characters real characters, like you and I, who have to be afraid and scared? Or are they different? Rashi makes them special. Go ahead.
And when Hashem said to him, your seed will be like the dust of the earth, he didn't know it referred to these people now or to others. Joseph.
Okay,
was
so here we go. Let's just analyze that.
Okay.
Yes, he was promised his seed would be like the dust of the earth. So if Esau destroys his entire camp, how is he going to be like the dust of the earth? Yes, but that can happen later. Abraham only had one son, and his seed was like the dust of the earth. What if all the 12 sons and all their children and all the slaves, what if it all goes away and he only has one left?
Or if he was conquered, he would be the dust.
Right. It'd be a different interpretation, right? Right. And then similarly, he gives corollaries. Go ahead, Joseph.
Joseph was sold when he was alive. And he didn't know, for the prophet doesn't know the hidden things, but Hashem doesn't reveal it. Elisha says, Hashem has hidden it from me and didn't tell me.
So he brings a wonderful proof from Elisha, from the Book of Kings. Elisha was a student of Elijah. He was one of the best and most miraculous prophets ever, prescient people you could imagine. He knew when people were coming to visit him. But there was a case where one of the boys who was taking care of him died, and God didn't tell him. There are times when God doesn't tell you. So he may not have known if he would survive this or not. So I think Ibn Ezra is suspicious of Rashi's pietistic reading of this text, that a holy man is always assured of his survival, right? You can look back at people who survived the Holocaust, and some rabbi or a holy person in your shul, and say, well, surely they trusted the whole time that everything would be great. I think most of us would feel that was reading backwards and it was presumptuous. Okay, so number one, we see that Ibn Ezra is claiming to be more pshat, more simple reading, whereas he claims that Rashi is a fanciful reading. Now, we can defend Rashi here and say, that's a simple reading. He said the words, and it will be a survival. So we, the readers, could read that there you go. He said he would survive. Isn't that beautiful? Rashi said we shall survive. Ramban, perhaps using the lens of meaning, actually says about this, and I'm going off topic a little bit because that's next week's topic, but going back to last week's lens of meaning, Ramban says this could be a hint to how Jewish communities work. We some of us are in Australia, some are in Budapest, and some are over here, and there's always a camp that's left, and Jacob said those words. He sensed that that's how Jews will survive. They'll be divide and conquer, divide and survive. And so it could be that Rashi is heading more toward that lens of meaning. But Ibn Ezra is not so interested in meaning. He wants a simple meaning. Simple meaning is the man is very scared of his brother. He has no idea what's going to happen. Period. Don't give me any pietistic prophetic readings unless we're told that he has a prophecy that he's going to be okay. Specifically, in this case, we assume he's scared. Moving along. Then he makes fun of Rashi's Arabic. In the next section, he says, right, he said that the Arabic, the man, it's not important what the Arabic is, but the point is, Ibn Ezra views himself as more of a sophisticate than Rashi. It's not just Ibn Ezra versus Rashi, it's Spain versus Ashkenaz. They view themselves as sophisticated, philosophers, etc., grammarians, and poets, and they viewed the people up north as knaves, as simple Talmudic scholars who didn't understand things about Hebrew and simple reading of the text. And in fact, he likes to make fun of Ashkenazic poetry as overly sophisticated and not elegant and beautiful enough. So he makes fun of Rashi's obvious lack of knowledge of Arabic, and it's admirable that Rashi tried to get some information about Arabic, but he kind of makes fun of him by saying, whoever told him that was wrong. In other words, I don't even imagine that he knew any Arabic, but whoever told him that was wrong. The one who told Rashi that Israel. Okay, Rabbeinu Shlomo. Okay, moving along. Page 2, the next source. Case of Jethro. So again here, I'm not quite sure what he's getting at, but let's try to understand the debate between Rashi and Ibn Ezra on this next case. So let's read the verse first. Scott, would you read the verse first, but when Moses?
When Moses' father-in-law saw how much he had to do for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing to the people? Why do you act alone? While all the people stand about you from morning until evening?"
Yes. We know that Jethro tried to give his son-in-law some advice. He was very kind, and Moshe hadn't delegated anything. He was doing everything by himself. And he told him, "You're going to die from this. You've got to delegate. So you should create a bureaucracy underneath you, and you should deal with the big cases." So he said, "Everyone's standing over you from morning to evening." So the commentators are wondering, "What do you mean standing over you? What does that mean, standing over you?" So here, I don't think we have this Rashi. Sometimes we don't have the supposed commentary that Rashi supposedly had. He had a different text. But let's see what he says. Rabbeinu Shlomo. Scott, would you continue?
Rabbeinu Shlomo said that the problem was that Moshe was sitting alone and Israel was standing, and it is not nice.
Here Moshe was sitting and everyone was standing. So he says, that's not nice. That's not Musar, it's not an ethical kind of a thing. What's your reaction to that?
It's not shot.
Why?
Well, the clear meaning of that is that everyone was standing around doing nothing. While Moses was doing all of the work.
Oh, interesting.
You don't see that from the text at all. What you see is that Moses is sitting and everyone else is standing.
Mm-hmm. Right, but what's the context? The context is he's judging. And when you judge, who sits?
The judge.
And the people?
Stand.
You take the stand, right? But today we let them sit. But usually you stand when you litigants come forward. It says in the Torah, "Amdu shnei Hashem shalahem ariv." Those who have a dispute should stand up and stand before the other.
It says stand about, mm-hmm. not stand around. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't say necessary that Moses was sitting.
It does.
Where is it?
He does right before that, yeah.
Okay. All right, good.
Let's see.
The
translation is very bad. It says you act alone. It should say you sit alone. Yeah. Why do you sit alone? I'm sorry, it should say that. Mm-hmm. But in any event, the Ibn Ezra says that he was sitting, and everyone was standing. Right, it says you're sitting. So, finish up, Scott. Now Ibn Ezra will tell us what he thinks. Go ahead.
And Moshe did it the right way, for a judge sits in a disputed stand, and he only asks about it in that he was alone to judge, and there were no judges to help him.
Now, the only thing that the father-in-law complained was he was alone. That's the emphasis. Underline the word alone. Don't underline the word sitting. There's nothing wrong with him sitting. That's what judges do. So again, you could just say, two people reading the text, you might say that Rashi's being overly picky. Rashi wants every word to have meaning. So if it's a complaint, and the complaint is, "You foolish son-in-law, every word should be a complaint. You're sitting," complaint number one. "Everyone else is standing," complaint number two. But Ibn Ezra says, not every word has to have meaning. Here we get to a very important anti-midrashic reading. In the midrash, every word matters. When you're trying to do pshat, you're saying, people write in interesting ways. People throw in expressions that don't have that much meaning. When God writes, he also does that. That's how you write. That's the simple meaning. And if he said that everyone, you're sitting and everyone's standing, it could mean that the only complaint was that everyone was standing. And the fact that he said sitting, it's insignificant. So here we get to another difference between Rashi and Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is willing to cast off one of the expressions as meaningless, and Rashi wants to squeeze every expression for meaning, or at least for some sort of meaning.
He was pretty much against Midrash with Ibn Ezra.
Ah, so we're going to get to that. Is Ibn Ezra against Midrash? We'll get to that in a moment. Okay. Right, that would make him very radical, because Midrash is written by the rabbi. Right. So is he against the rabbi? He's not a rabbi, he's just a grammarian, a poet, he's a lot of things, but he is not a Talmudic rabbi, which would basically make him not a rabbi. Moving along, the breastplate. Now, there's a very strange thing. The Torah says, and you should take and that breastplate, which was shaped like this, and then you fold it in half, and there were the stones over here. On that breastplate, you should put into it the Urim Vitumim. What is that, the motto of Yale? Is it? The Urim Vitumim?
Yeah.
It says Urim Vitumim. But what the Urim Vitumim are, we don't know. Mm-hmm. The breastplate of the high priest was called the Choshen, and inside was the Urim Vitumim. What's the Urim Vitumim? So there are 5-6 different theories. Let's take a look at the difference between Rashi and Ibn Ezra, and tell me, is anybody here giving the pshat, the simple man? All right, we'd like to read that for us. Debbie?
We can say that the Urim are also the Tumim, because it says to the Urim and Tumim, as opposed to the Urim and the Tumim.
In other words, the word to, it says to the Urim and to the Tumim. They're the same. I don't know. I don't really understand the argument. Let's continue.
As opposed to the Urim and to the Tumim.
Right. The word two is not repeated twice. Right. So it's that. You could say that that means that they're different. They're the same. Anyway, let's continue. But Rabbeinu Shlomo.
Rabbeinu Shlomo said that the Urim and the Tumim are the writing of the explicit name of God.
So you take this Choshen Mishpat, you fold it up, you take the explicit name of God, which we don't know what it is, maybe the 42-letter name of God, the 72-letter, whatever it is, and you stick it inside, and now it's a holy thing, it's a prognosticating vessel, because now it has the holy name of God. Does the word Urim and Tumim, which means the lights and the whole thing, the pure thing, does that have anything to do with the name of God? The name of God is the light. It's hard to say. This is Rashi tradition. This is the rabbinic tradition. Go ahead.
And if he had seen the writings of Rav Gaon, he would not have said
that.
Yeah.
Right. So, I'm sorry, I couldn't find the writings of Rav Gaon, but in any event, he's claiming that earlier authorities deny that that's true. Let's continue. I forgot to translate that. So he says the truth. Oh, I have a short translation to the next paragraph. The truth is, it's like their name, and therefore he says what they actually put in there. Well, the Ramban summarizes what Ibn Ezra is very difficult to understand what he says. So the Ramban, living after a little bit after the Ibn Ezra, claims that what he says is he thought they were imagers that astrologers used to know the thoughts of the questioner. He used some kind of astrological copper thingamajig that had the zodiac signs on it, and he stuck it in there. One of the things that Ibn Ezra is an astrologer. Mm-hmm. And he believed in Greek/Arabic astrology. Now, is that the simple meaning of the text? The lights? The lights, it could be the stars, I don't know. So now we begin to see that when he approaches the text, he's looking at the simple meaning of the text, and he also thinks that there's always something astrological going on. If you want to prognosticate the future, you want to have something to do with the astrology. Strange. We'll come back to the Ibn Ezra and astrology in a moment. So we begin to see that there's more going on here than just Rashi leans, is trying to do, says he's doing pshat, a simple reading, but actually he was more interested in meaning, he was more interested in midrash, traditional stories and legends and interpretations the rabbis had. But the Ibn Ezra was very interested in the pshat and the simple meaning, and we saw that sometimes he complains that Rashi's not simple enough, it's not the straight meaning, it's a forced meaning. But we also see that sometimes he wants to superimpose on the text something from astrology, which for him is equivalent to science. Don't look down at him because he's an astrologer. Look up to him. He's modern Orthodox. He believes in Torah and the science of the dead, which was astrology, the four elements, you know, what is it, earth, fire, water, and air.
Wind.
So he believes in these, he believes that this is truth. Okay. Let me get back to truth. So is it Ibn Ezra a man of pshat, of a simple meaning? Well, let's see what he says. In one of his books called the Safa, he wrote other books, Safa Brura, he says the following about Rashi. Who would like to read that? Nancy?
He, Rashi, felt that he was in accordance with the way of pshat, simple meaning, and his words are only pshat when in fact.
So he's rarely, so he claims, so the self-perception is that I, however, am completely pshat, but he just told us that the Urim and Thummim, the lights and the are astrological things that he has from the Middle Ages. Okay, so we've got some strange stuff going on. What about Ibn Ezra's stated purpose? See, unlike last week, where Rashi, as again, not a sophisticate, Rashi does not write an introduction to his commentary. Ibn Ezra, as a sophisticate, having read other treatises in Arabic, Judeo-Arabic, and things like that, he wrote an introduction to his commentary in a poetry form. And there he explains his stated purpose. Again, don't forget, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, my teacher and professor, said that never believe someone in their introduction. We have to see what they do in the commentary, not in the introduction. But nonetheless, let's see what he says in his introduction. So there's a little poetic line there. And what does he say, Nancy?
The foundation I will place my commentary on, which is straight in my eyes, which is to the face of God.
Something like that. Nochach Pnei Hashem. Here we may be getting a little bit toward that idea of truth. It's straight across the face of God, meaning it's what God intended. Something like that, right? But it's also pshat, simple meaning.
All right. Arrogant to me. Rashi didn't come across that way.
Yes. There are poems in which he's very humble. He said he tried to get in to see the Rambam. He went to Egypt and he couldn't get in. He was too busy and he's miserable and he was always poor. Nobody, I guess, you know, he couldn't make a living being a poet and all that. So there is that image of him. But yes, in the commentary, he's brutal. We're pursuing truth after all. Let's continue in that introduction, he goes on, go ahead.
And because of the drash, the simple meaning pshat, is not lost. For there are 70 faces to the Torah.
So one second. So, just because there is drash, there's still pshat. So it's a wonderful dual system. I think it was Uriel Simon who wrote an article about the religious significance of the pshat. Even though the rabbis say that verse X means X, Y, and Z, but there's also religious significance to what you think the simple meaning of the text is as well. Of course, our lives are guided by the Midrashic reading. They tell us what to do. But we could gain insights and inspiration from the simple meaning apart from the rabbinic reading, because the rabbis said, or they themselves said, there are 70 faces to the Torah. So when you read the simple meaning, that surely is one of the main faces of the Torah. Continue.
But among the laws and Torahs and statutes, if we find two explanations for a verse, and one is like the sages who were all righteous, we will depend on their truth without a doubt.
Okay. So when he's dealing with stories, he's going to be pretty brutal. He wants the simple meaning, and the rabbis can do what they want. And that's very nice and it's good, but I am entitled to my simple meaning. When it comes to laws, okay, let's say, we'll get to it later, let's say he thinks that tefillin is just a metaphor. You should bind them as a sign on your eyes. He doesn't think that, but if let's say he thought that, like the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, thought just in some cases, it could be just a metaphor in Shemot. But since the rabbis say it's not a metaphor, it's not a metaphor. So he says, if there are different meanings, and one is a meaning according to the rabbis, who are so righteous, we're going to lean on their truth. Al amitam, on their truth. There's the truth of the rabbis. So now, if you're trying to characterize this man, this Ibn Ezra, as to what he's trying to do in his commentary. First we said, oh, the simple meaning. Whatever is a simple reading of the text, that's what he's getting at. And then we say, yes, but he also thinks that the rabbis have a truth. If the rabbi said it, it's true. Not always. If it's in the story section, he's not so sure. We'll get to it later. But when it comes to areas touching on Jewish law within the Torah, if he can, he's going to stick with the rabbinic way because he's going to depend on their truth. So A, he's looking for truth, and B, pshat, a simple meaning of the text is not the only thing that drives his commentary. Again, the simple meaning of the text is not the only thing that drives his commentary. He's also looking at the rabbinic meaning of a text, which he believes is true. So now we have to say, well, so we thought pshat was driving him. There's in addition to pshat, there's also rabbinic things which are true. So what's driving his commentary?
Truth.
It's really the lens of truth. And for him, truth would be, so far, rabbinic reading. It's going to go beyond that. We're going to get further than that. Let's prove again. Let's go back to the question of Ibn Ezra being interested in the simple meaning. Simple meaning, by the way, has to do, it may not be so simple to get to the simple. When we say simple, it doesn't mean what a third grader would say. Simple is using all the rules of grammar and syntax and everything we know, philology that we know, comparative language, then what's the simple meaning? Without being influenced by outside things, supposedly. So here's a famous Ibn Ezra about something we say in the Haggadah. We say in the Haggadah, my father was a wandering Aramean, and then he went down to Egypt, and Laban, who was the Laban was the Aramean. He tried to destroy my father. You notice in the Haggadah, they're sometimes schizophrenic. The Haggadah is saying that Laban was the Aramean. The translators, sometimes in the plain Haggadah, they sometimes say, they take the verse and they translate, my father was a wandering Aramean. That's, you just, those two interpretations are this classical interpretations versus Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says, we'll see one second. Take a look at Ibn Ezra. Take a look at Ibn Ezra. Okay. So the key word is, that's why I gave you a little hint here. An Aramean, a wanderer, my father. So let me show you, I'll tell you what, just look at the bottom line for a moment. In Hebrew, that's all it says. Arami, an Aramean. Oved, wanderer. Avi, my father. It doesn't make sense. An Aramean, a wanderer, my father? Well, that could be, you know, three, you know, two clauses explaining who my father was. Or, an Aramean wandered my father. The transitive verb. He wandered, he wasted him. He wasted my father. He tried to waste my father. He tried to destroy my father. And that's why Laban is so bad. He's worse than Pharaoh, says the Haggadah, says the Midrash. Simple reading. An Aramean, a wanderer, was my father. And then he went down to Egypt. Which father was a wandering Aramean, went down to Egypt, and became a great nation? Which one? Probably Jacob. Let's take a look at Ibn Ezra. Lost. Racha, could you read it for us?
Lost is an intransitive verb.
So it doesn't say my father destroyed, an Aramean destroyed my father, a transitive verb that needs an object, but it just, it's an intransitive verb. My father, let's see how he takes it. Go ahead.
If the Aramean referred to Laban, then the verb would be in the transitive, hifil or piel form.
So he gives you the different grammatical forms. Go ahead.
Besides, what sense is there to say, Laban tried to destroy my forefather and he went down to Egypt? Laban never considered going down to Egypt.
You see that? You see, the way the rabbi is reading, he has to read it like this. Laban tried to destroy my forefather and he, my forefather, went down to Egypt. That's not, you don't usually read it. That's not simple reading. Usually the subject remains the subject. So Lavan tried to destroy my father, and he, Lavan, went down to Egypt. But we know Lavan is an Aramean. He never left Aram. So it's wrong. Continue.
The plausible interpretation is that the Aramean refers to Yaakov, as if Scripture had said, when my forefather was in Aramea, he was lost.
Lost being an intransitive verb.
Meaning he was a pauper without property. Compare, give strong drink to him who is lost, where it is immediately followed by, let him drink and forget his poverty. Thus, the lost Aramean was my forefather. The intent of this passage is, I did not inherit this land from my forefather, for he was a pauper when he came to Aramea.
Right, et cetera, et cetera. So, using a good sound grammar and forms of grammar, he understands the verse differently from the rabbis, again rejecting Midrashic interpretation. Notice not very little apology here, because whether we say that the verse is referring to Laban or Jacob doesn't change how you practice Jewish law, so it's not so upsetting for the rabbinic world, so he doesn't have to apologize about how he's going against the rabbis. Let's continue. Now we get to something, the idea of repetition. Again, what's the idea of Midrash? The word Midrash, what does it mean? Darash is to investigate. That every single word you have, like pearls, you invest, oh, what does this word mean? What does that word mean? Why did you use this form of the word? Why not that form? And how come over here he said it this way, and over there he said it that way? You're a simple reader, or a modern literary reader. You say, let's take the story of, let's say, Eliezer. Eliezer's story is told three times. The narrator says, Eliezer went down to find the girl, and then he said, made a deal with God about what type of girl would be good. Then, it actually happens, and then he tells the story over again to the family. Each time it's told slightly differently. Is that because there's a great significance to the way it's told each time? Or, if you're a good writer, you don't write the same thing three times. So, which side is Ibn Ezra going to be on?
That every word has its purpose. No.
That's Midrash. That would be Midrash. Mm-hmm. Every word has its purpose is Midrash, the investigation. And the literary approach is that, there are different types of close reading. The close reading, Midrash agrees with the modern idea of close reading. Close reading says every word is important. After all, he wrote it, so it must have had a significance. But there are those who say, and there's such an opinion in the Talmud as well, that the Torah speaks in human language. And in human language, you change it up. You throw a curveball. You don't use the same words over and over. So here are two examples, one in the text and one that Ibn Ezra will bring. Then in the middle of the night, who would like to compare these two verses for us? Let's see. Dr. Would you? Two verses in the middle.
In the middle of the night, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. From the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon.
Okay, so the captive was in the... Where do you put the captive? In the dungeon. In other words, very slaves, they land out in the dungeon. Go ahead.
And all the firstborn of the captive.
That's when it actually happened. Sorry, I should have put it the other way around. But when it was told that it would happen, what does it say?
And every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstone.
Ah, so the slave girl is behind the millstone. Why isn't she thrown in the pit? So are these two different slaves? Did he promise one thing and then it happened the other way? The guy was going to smite the firstborn of the slave girl, but he landed out smiting the slave boys. I mean, what's the significance? It comes Ibn Ezra and said, "Go ahead, doctor."
I already said that the prophets do not guard words, just means, like the words ha'imi and hashka'imi. Rivka and the water.
Right, so he invokes the Rivka story, that in one story he says, you should bestow the water on me, and the other one he says, you should water me. So, it's the same thing. Go ahead.
Or Zahor and Shamor.
Right, and Friday night we talk about Zahor, the two commandments, right? According to Ibn Ezra, don't tell me that Zahor and Shamor are different. They're the same. They're the same. Continue.
Guard and remember. And false and in vain.
Right? Don't take an oath in vain. Don't take an oath falsely. Same thing. Right? Because if you're a legalist, it's a big difference. But if you're a simple reader, it's the same. Go ahead.
Do not desire and do not covet are equal in meaning.
By the way, it works out a little better. You see, according to, if you say that you're close reading, midrashic reading, then you've got a problem. There's one version of the Ten Commandments that says one thing, and the other version says something else. Oh my! But according to him, relax. Prophets don't give the same words, they just give the same meaning. So as long as it's the same meaning, it's fine. They don't have to say the same thing every time. It's not the words, it's the meaning. Right? In other words, if we get a little more philosophical, you could say, God said it in a more ethereal kind of way. There wasn't an exact word, it was a feeling. And then they just tell it the way they choose to tell it this time, and the next time, it doesn't make a difference. This is not what we learn in yeshiva. Okay. By the way, Ibn Ezra is not very popular in a lot of yeshivas because he's not a rabbi, so what authority does he have to say anything? He's not a Talmudist, sorry?
He doesn't have the credentials.
Does not have credentials. And number two, he has some radical ideas. Some of which I'm not even telling you tonight.
He's a poet.
He is in the classical editions of the classical editions of the Chumash do include him because Ramban, who's very kosher, as we'll see next week, does quote him. Let me tell you what the Ramban says. Ramban, in his introduction, in Spanish, he says, Rashi, you know, I'm going to disagree with him, but it's all out of great love. But with the Ibn Ezra, I have a tochacha megula on the front, on the surface of it. I'm just always rebuking him. I have ahava nisteret, I have a hidden love for. So that's, I think, the relationship of many rabbinic Jews with Ibn Ezra is they love the guy. He's such a great poet. We read his poetry in the synagogue, you know, every now and then. Not enough. Dishabav or on Yom Kippur, you'll see Ibn Ezra wrote the song. We have on Shabbos and our Benjers and our Zmirot. He has one of the songs, beautiful song. And you know, he's one of the main commentators. But on the other hand, you can't accept everything he says. He has some radical ideas. So this is one of them, and he's not the only one who says this. But as I said, in the Talmud itself, there's an opinion that says. That don't get carried away if it says he shall surely die. Wasn't he just saying he'll die? Because that's an expression. Mot yumat. I mean, it's just an expression. It's repeated twice. So the Talmud is aware of that, but it's not generally the Talmudic way. Okay, let's continue. I don't think we have time for the Masoretes, but I'll just share with you an interesting. Here's something that's. I don't know if it's radical or not radical. There's something that's very strange. It's a radical rabbinic idea, and it comes from the Masoretes. In around the 8th, 9th century, in Syria, Babylonia, there were Masoretes. They were lunatics. No, they used to count every word of the Torah as it appears in every different form. So if it's a particular spelling of a word, they would tell you, this spelling appears three times, and these are the three times. And this is why the three times. And this time it's spelled with a vav, and this time without a vav, and this is why. And this time, this phrase is not supposed to be this way. The early scribes changed the text so it shouldn't be so blasphemous. And they changed it around, like, God doesn't stand in front of Abraham, Abraham stands in front of God. So someone changed it years ago. Ibn Ezra, in a radical mood, says, I don't accept that. I like the text the way it is. I don't see any problem with it. God stood in front of Abraham, what's the problem? So I don't know if that's traditional or not traditional. He's trying to be very devoted to the text. Right? And yet, he says, one spelling versus another spelling? There's a lot of spellings. How do we know? It may be a change. Now, there is a rabbinic idea that our Torahs today is exactly the same as Moses, but there could be a vav or yud here or there that are off. We don't claim that we have all the vavs and yuds. Right? So we would agree to a degree with him that to make an interpretation why here it's with a vav and there without a vav. Maybe the Masoretes had a good text, but we don't. We don't know where. So it's interesting his relationship to this Masoretic tradition. It's all like the Reish. I'm not sure as much. Not as much, but sometimes, you know, it says, you read it this way,
yeah.
But in parentheses it says it's written the other way. Or it's written one way, in parentheses it says you're supposed to read it a different way. Sometimes you're reading the Torah in the parentheses, and it says, no, you should, this word, you should pronounce it this way, even though the letter seems to say this, but the tradition is the Masorah, the tradition from those punctilious rabbis, or people, some of whom may have been Karaite, they said you should read it this way. So he says, says it's not so important. What?
In Megillus Esther we see it.
Yeah, very strange. In Ruth there's a lot of cases where nothing is written, and the tradition is that you should read something. Nothing is written. Yes.
In the Esther where it says something about Masoretic text where it counts of words. And
yeah, yeah. If you look in this, if you ever look in that green Chumash, on the side of the line, it gives you the Masoretic notes, and it tells you three times it says this phrase. If you want, afterwards I'll show you. Okay, let's move on. Sorry?
They count the words.
In general, they're counters of words. Now, we have to understand something. And I'm missing a piece of information. One of his agendas is that there are serious scholars in Spain who are Karaites. They don't accept rabbinic tradition, and they're arguing with him. Now, you would think that that would force him to abandon the simple meaning, because that's what the Karaites do, and go to the rabbinic meaning. But instead, he says, no, I'm going to be better at the simple meaning than the Karaites. And one of the many people he quotes, like Hertz, quotes a lot of Gentile and German biblical scholars, and people get annoyed. He quotes a lot of Karaites, like Ibn Bilam. Usually he quotes them to criticize him. Sometimes he doesn't. He quotes them because he likes their interpretation. He was dealing with great, great scholars of grammar, etc. Now, how that fits into his rejection of the Masoretes, we have to think about. Let's move on. Now, he does seem to reject some midrash. Here's an easy one that Rashi says, you know why? What it means that Abraham, in order to fight his battle to save Lot, he gathered 318 men? You know what it means? 318 is the gematria of Eliezer. He didn't send any men. He sent one man, and one man defeated all the armies. He's a miracle worker like Shmuel, like Moses. He doesn't fight real battles. He fights them miraculously. What's the basis of this? 318 and Eliezer, as I show here, it's the same, it's 318. So Ibn Ezra says, audaciously, Barbara? And the calculation.
318 men?
No, the next one. And the calculation. Gematrias.
For everyone who wishes can take every word for good or for bad, rather than the word means what it
says. The very severe criticism of gematria. If I say, I want to tell you, the gematria of my name is Mashiach, so I'm the Mashiach. So what do you say? Yeah, so someone does a quick calculation and says, excuse me, your name is also Russia, a wicked person. You know? So the gematria could go in many different directions. So he says, that's not a way to read the Torah. The Torah doesn't speak in gematria. Even the rabbis admit that gematria is just for fun, it's not really. But in any event, Rashi quotes this gematria, and he doesn't like it. So he seems to reject, but he doesn't always reject the midrash. Let's take a look. Here on page 6. He said, how honorable is the drash that the darshan, that the people who strayed with water, they're the people of the generation of flood, they sin with water, and they went down with water. I think the sexual sins, it relates to fluids and water, something like that. And they went down with water. They were judged with water. Okay, so he likes certain midrash. He doesn't. He sometimes quotes midrash favorably. Not often, but once in a while.
In that example, the drash doesn't change the text.
Yes, yes. As a matter of right, this might relate to last week's topic of meaning. He says, you know, it's a nice thought. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the text. We're looking, it's a meta-textual comment. In other words, you look away from the text and you say, that's interesting. They sinned with water, with liquid, and they suffered in liquid. So that's interesting. But you're right, it's really not, has nothing to do with the simple meaning of the text. But at least he's quoting Midrash in a positive way. Then we have a problem with rabbinic identification of personalities. The rabbis have something which Sholem Karmi called the principle of the conservation of personalities. We have someone we know named Sarah. We all know her and love her. Sarah, her original name was Sarai. We have someone else in Abraham's family. Almost everybody becomes somebody. You know, his brother Nahor is the father of all the matriarchs. His brother Haran is the father of Lot and Amon and Ruth and everybody. So everybody in the family tree is somebody. But there's one woman who is nobody, Yiska. So the rabbis say, Yiska must be Sarah. And Abraham's married to his relative, as he tells us in the text. She's his sister somehow. He's related to her. So Yiska is Sarah. Right? Abraham's niece, Yiska, is Sarah. Rashi likes that. Conservation of personalities. Midrash. We don't know who she is. Let's say we know who she is. Why should we be left frustrated? See, scholars love to say, we don't know. Right? His father loves to say, there's some things we don't know. It's ancient. We have no way of knowing. Rabbis don't like to say that. They like to say, we know everything. We can figure, we have enough tools. We have the tools in the Torah to figure everything out. That's what they like to say. Right? So comes the Ibn Ezra and says, our predecessor says that Yiska is Sarah. And if it's her tradition, we'll accept it. Mm-hmm. This is a brilliant move. Agnosticism. Right? He says, look, I'm a rabbinic Jew. I keep Shabbos like Jews, not like the Karaites. If the rabbis say they have a tradition, going back to Moses, that Yiska is Sarah, I accept it. I don't have a problem. But by the way, if they don't, I reject it. If it's just their opinion, if it's just a rabbinic opinion, I have my opinion. I don't think, it doesn't work. I see no reason that she should be Sarah. So if this is, does he reject rabbinic interpretation? Not really. We said before that when he has Jewish law, he's going to put the rabbinic interpretation on top. And we said before, and we say now, that if he accepts, if they have a rabbinic tradition, and he doesn't know if they do or they don't, if they have a rabbinic tradition, he accepts it. Again, we don't know when they make a midrash, are they making it up from thin air like we make up interpretations? Or are they giving a tradition from Sinai, from Moses? We don't know. And he doesn't know either.
Is he giving himself some legitimacy by doing this?
Yeah. I mean, is he giving himself too much, a puffed up sense of legitimacy? Right. In other words, he would say he might be arguing that the only force the rabbis have over him is tradition,
right?
Not logic.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. Right. A more traditional yeshiva Jew today would say, no, they have authority by virtue of being in that generation. Yeah. And they were imbued with the tradition in general, which gives them authority in other things.
Right.
Right. But he seems to have a more radical view. Okay. Now, what was I talking about? The lens of truth. What is that talking about? So, again, there are a lot of very difficult passages in the Ibn Ezra. A, because his Hebrew, strangely enough, is clunky. And number two, because he's trying to hide what he's saying. And number three, because he's referring to all these things that I don't understand about astrology and other stuff. But in any event, he says here that there's a lot to say. I don't want to overdo it.
This is good.
Let's see. I thought we would say the following. That on page 7, he says the proof that the angels that guard the Garden of Eden, if you're not familiar, outside the Garden of Eden, are cherubs. What are cherubs? We don't know. So sometimes cherubs are angels. And the rabbis say that in Aramaic, the cherubim are the face of a children. But he says, I know from Ezekiel that the face of the throne of God has more than children. It has an ox, a person, and what else? And a calf. That's where they got the golden calf from there. But in any event, so maybe it's all the faces. And the proof, that which it says later, the cherubs are known as angels with a sword in hand, as it has two sides. It's turning. I think, I can't prove it, I don't know for sure. I think he's saying that we know that angels hold swords with two sides. And therefore, that's what it's got to be. And it's part of the theory of truth. Because that's what he knows that they are. We have another example, a better example, elsewhere. Let me... we talk about science. Turn to page 8. In the middle. It's Moses says that all the ways of God are true. He says, what does that mean? That they are uniform. All things change according to their needs. And the needs of our... Don't ask me from the standing of the sun in Joshua, for its secret is clear. The word, the moon, and the valley, as I explained. He doesn't tell you what he's talking about, but more or less he's saying the following. The ways of God are like a law. They're uniform. If the sun rises and the sun sets, the sun rises and the sun sets. But wait a second. It says in Joshua that Joshua stopped the sun. He says, I explained that over there. We don't have his commentary on Joshua, but you can imagine what he explained. Not the traditional interpretation. It doesn't mean the sun always rises and always sets. Whatever it means, it doesn't mean what it seems to be saying. Because the highest truth is science, nature. We know how it works. So what is the meaning of Joshua? The true meaning has to abide by the truth. And the truth is the sun rises and the sun sets. Laws of God, it says right here, Moses says at the end of the Torah, the laws are, all his ways are law. The ways of nature are a law. They're laws of nature. Or, he says, it says in Exodus 23, you should worship God. God will bless your bread, will bless your water, and he'll take away all illness. So, he says the following. Who would like to read it? Nancy, would you read it for on page 9, top of the page? So this is apparently in some of the so-called commentaries. It's actually a secondary commentary. His students wrote it. There's the long version and the short version. So anyway, they quote him. Go ahead.
There are great sages of both Torahs, oral and written, and they did not engage in the wisdom of Toldot, so they could not explain the blessings. And I will mention some.
Okay, so first he's saying, you all know that I'm not a scholar of both Torahs. I'm only a scholar of one Torah. I don't know the oral Torah. I'm not a Talmudic rabbi, says the Ibn Ezra. I'm just a Tanakh rabbi, a biblical rabbi. And again, I'm not sure you can be a biblical scholar. I'll take the word rabbi out of it. And they don't know the wisdom of Toldot, of how the souls come out of human beings or something like that. I don't know exactly, something like that. And therefore, I'll explain it to you based on Greek thinking, I'll explain how it works, but you guys who know all the Talmud, you can't explain these blessings in these verses. Continue. Now,
one who keeps the Torah does not need a doctor other than Hashem. Therefore it says...
Now, by the way, this is not some medievalist who's saying, oh, just believe in God. No. He's saying, I can explain based on Greek science why all the humors and everything will work out great if you connect with your spiritual soul part of yourself, which is, it's like homeopathic medicine, that because if you had it all connected right, then you wouldn't be sick to begin with, you wouldn't get your allergies and all that, right? And you would be everything would be great. And he's not saying it, don't view this as a medievalist in the sense of like backward. No, he's trying to be progressive because he knows all the science of Toldot. He views himself as more progressive than the mere rabbis who just know the Talmud and don't understand these intricacies. Go ahead.
Therefore it says, in his illness he did not seek Hashem, but the doctors.
One of the kings, it was terrible. He got sick, and instead of seeking the doctors, he instead of speaking God, he sought the doctors. Go ahead.
And then there is the wisdom
of the spirit. So he explains, I didn't translate the whole thing, because I don't have the vocabulary, but he explains that somehow... The transmission of your soul to the body and somehow it gets disrupted and something like that. And then he says also the spheres have an influence on our health. The spheres. But go ahead.
And it will be according to every woman.
I'm sorry.
That she should miscarry, for the nature of the womb nourishes the children, or she will be barren. But if he come to Hashem and his
Moled, meaning and that system of going from the spirit to the physical and all that. Again, I'm sorry, this is horrible theology from a modern point of view. I apologize for that. But my point is that he believes that this is how we're going to explain the verses. we're going to explain it based on this kind of medieval Greek Arabic science. Again, the Arabs were experts in and some of the Jews helped them to translate from the Greek into the Arabic, which they were Arabic, and then the Jews would read it in the Arabic, which they were Arabic, and then they became great scholars of Greek / Arabic thing. Go ahead.
Because they became bilingual.
Oh, yes.
The souls, etc. And if according to the stars, he would not give birth, if he clung, then the strength of the kidneys would win. Fix his
knee. His seed.
So he would give birth.
Right, so something like that. I have no idea what it's talking about. But the point is that he believed that this is how you explain the verses. Because if you really know, if you really know homeopathic medicine, and you really know the way things really work, right, and you're a bissel doctor and scientist like I am, then you would understand why if you worship God, then you don't get sick and you won't have miscarriages. It's simple. That's the simple meaning of the text.
Well, what about the natural law of things? I mean, the sun rises, the sun sets, there's death, unfortunately.
Right. But this is all, for him, this is also part of nature. This is not, again, metaphysics and physics, for them, it's all the same thing. So this is the natural way it works. It's a science of toladot, of how things go from the spiritual to the physical, because it's all connected, etc. Again, there's no secular science in those days. In any event, so let me just see one more thing here. One second. Okay. So now let's turn to some modern scholars and see what do they do, page 7. What do they do with this guy? How do you explain? What is he about? Is he about the simple meaning? Should we put him in the category with the Rashi's grandson who said, you know, Grandpa, you said you were going to explain it according to the simple meaning, but I see a lot of midrash here. Don't you think you should reconsider your commentary? And supposedly Rashi said, sure, grandson, if I had time, I would rewrite it according to only the simple meaning of the text. So Rashbam is a pure man who's only interested in the simple reading of the text. But what is this Ebn Ezra guy? What is he interested in? Sometimes he accepts the rabbis because he's not a Karaite, and it's very important to him not to be a Karaite. He's fighting them. And he also accepts all these sciences and he's putting that in the verse. That's not the simple meaning. So what is this guy? So I was privileged when I was a young, master's student and considering my PhD and all that in Jewish studies. So I went to the Congress HaOlami, the National Congress of Jewish Studies, and Professor Uliel Simon spoke and Sarah Yefet spoke. And they critiqued each other, and they had a somewhat picayune debate about what the Ibn Ezra is. What is it? So I'm going to quote Sarah Yefet, a woman professor, and Uriel Simon, an older statesman. He's about 90 years old now. Good news for people with cancer. At that time, she had cancer, and my cousin had to give the talk in her stead, but now she's 83 years old. Okay, but in any event, what has Sarah Yefet said? Who would like to read that? Doctor?
The Shah is no master above it. It has its own autonomy. There's no authority other than itself.
Page 7.
Well, it is responsible to the text itself.
Right. So, on the one hand, we've got a problem. She says, you know what Shah is? You're really just... Page 7. What is Shah? If you really believe in Shah in the simple meaning, that's it. The simple meaning rules. Simple meaning reigns. It's just the simple meaning, nothing else. Don't tell me the midrash. Don't tell me anything. It's just the simple meaning. So he said, well, what does rule? The text. What is it, logic? Or is it the text? What is it? So this is a very picayune question, but is it your what sounds most reasonable to you? Right? Now, reasonable to you because you have certain sensibilities, right? Ibn Ezra didn't like making too many miracles. Rashi said that she sent her arm and her arm extended. He's adding a new miracle to the text, not explicit in the text. Ibn Ezra didn't like that. Let's minimize the miracles. Not because he didn't believe in miracles, but it's simple text. If the text doesn't have a miracle, you can't add a miracle. On the other hand, there is a master. The master is not just your logic. The master is the text. What does that mean, the text? Whose text? Whose version of the text? Let's continue. Let's see. Professor Uliel Simon on, oh, by the way, regarding tefillin, the second to last paragraph, regarding tefillin, which could be interpreted figuratively, you could say that you should love the Torah so much you should bind it as a sign on your arm. You don't actually have to put it on your arm. You have to bind it as a sign on your arm, you know. You don't have to put it on your head. Right? Rashbam said that in Exodus, that's true. We don't know if Rashbam was willing to say that about Deuteronomy, but about the Shema, but he said it about Exodus, that when the tefillin appears in Exodus, he says it's a metaphor. But the Ibn Ezra says, no. What the sages transmitted to write the parsha, write these words, that's the truth. Is it a simple meaning? Usually, if someone says, write this on your arm, I wouldn't take it seriously. I wouldn't take it literally. I would take it seriously, not literally. Right? They say, embolden this, what's the word? You should put it on your, write it on your forehead. I say you should write this on your forehead. For instance, we have it in Song of Songs. Katvei Maluach Libecha, write it on the chalkboard of your heart. Right? So on the tablets of your heart. So it's nobody would take that physically, literally. But he says, it's the truth. The rabbi said, with the tefillin, that's the truth. I know that's the truth. I know that's from Sinai. I know that's from Moses. So that's the truth. So comes Uriel Simon, and he says, commentary.
Commentary has the lower hand when it comes to science in the Arab Greek sort.
Right. So the simple meaning takes its back seat to science. Continue.
In the quest for truth, there's no room for compromise. The true researcher cannot be afraid of true conclusions, be they what they might.
And, one second. We turn to the last page. Last page on the bottom, one of the outside sources of the outside of his commentary, he wrote in the book, he wrote the following. There are, bottom of page 9, who would like to read that? There are commandments. Well, Bracha, would you?
Oh, I'm sorry, bottom of page 9.
Yeah.
There are commandments which are clear, and some we don't know them in truth only from the holy transmitters of the Torah. And without them, we could explain many ways. And there are mitzvot which we got from them not mentioned in the Torah. And in general, if not for the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah and the people of the Mishnah and Talmud,
our
Torah would be lost. For all this kept it up and explained it well, and all they received. And sometimes they find clear evidence in the Torah, and some by way of rock, and some by way of hints in the text.
And after the
And those who understand can tell when it is simple and when it is drash, for it is not all.
So he's claiming as follows. There are parts of the oral tradition, part of the Talmud and the Midrash, that are clear laws, and they have a basis in the text. Some laws are just hinted to in the text, and some laws are not really hinted to very well at all. They just sort of tagged it onto the text. If you have a discerning eye, you can determine when the rabbinic reading is a simple reading. When it's just tagged onto the text as a midrash reading. And I am discerning enough that I will determine that. But I'm determined to tell you the truthful meaning of what the text is. I'm not going to tell you that the midrash is the pshat when it's not. The pshat is the pshat. So ultimately, he's interested in truth. And so let's go back and ask a question. I'm a Jew and I want to read this Torah in a way that makes the most sense. I'm a reasonable man. I'm a man of reason and logic and science and philosophy. And I want to read it in a reasonable way. If I come to the text, what are my tools that I use to be reasonable? Go ahead. What are the tools that one uses to be reasonable about your reading?
Logic.
So just plain brains.
The laws of grammar.
Grammar and syntax and philology and parallel languages. He knows a lot of Arabic. Arabic and Hebrew have a lot of common words. He knows some Aramaic from the Talmud. He's not ignorant of the Talmud. Okay. And then what else?
Common sense.
Right. Rashbam developed a whole theory, and this is in my, did some work on this in my master's level. Rashbam developed a whole theory of the way things work. You know, there are books like The Way Things Work. He was very aware of the way things work. How when someone is lowering the bucket of water, how does it work? And that's how you read the text, the way it works. How do you change a tire on an ancient wheel? I don't know. And that's how you should read the Talmud, the Bible, the way things are. And so you bring your common experience. And Rashi and Rashbam were experts in realia, in how things work, how you make wine, because the Talmud discusses it. How you, I don't know, pluck something from a tree. How you pull the scab off your finger. They need to know these things to explain the Talmud and the Torah. And then, if you happen to be a sophisticate and a scientist and a Westerner and an Andalusian, the grand early Spanish people, you know how you're going to also read it? You're going to read it through the eyes of the science of your day. And again, don't make fun of the science of their day. One day they'll make fun of the science of our day. Not as much, I hope, but they'll make fun of it a little bit. We're going to advance, hopefully. So he was a sophisticate in his day, and to him, there was no difference. Reading it with the rabbinic tradition is a true reading, makes it a really true reading. It's something I bring to the text, and I say, I'm not going to drop this. I know that the rabbis have certain traditions, and look, it's a reasonable reading of the text. So I'm going to say that this is the truth of the reading of this text. And I'm also going to bring to it my scientific knowledge, which we would consider pseudo-scientific. We would consider, you know, both places sometimes. But that's how he's going to bring the four elements and all these things to the reading of the text, because that's truth. And that's how you read the text. And really, it's a guide for us today, that we could read the text today as well, with the prism of truth. In other words, if you look at the issue, for instance, of evolution, we would say, the preponderance of evidence from DNA to science, anthropology, and skeletons, and excavation, et cetera, is that there was some sort of evolutionary process. Who guided it, how it happened, whatever the detail. You know, we don't, obviously God's in charge of everything. But I'm going to read Genesis in light of that, because I'm a believer in truth. And truth is a broader concept than just what it says in the Bible. Truth includes all the truth. And if I know something to be true from my studies of science, of course, we're often proven wrong on the morrow, but that's, we're human, so that's the way it works. But I'm going to bring my science, and I'm also going to bring my rabbinic tradition too. And together, that's going to give me the simple meaning of the text. So Rashi was quoting the rabbis because, like, he just couldn't help it. It was like, it was so good. He wanted to give you the simple meaning, but like he was so excited about this interpretation that he wants to give you a nice lesson so you can go home and teach it to your children and to your parents and so that's why Rashi quoted Midrash. Not because it was a simple reading. When he met with his grandson, he probably had to say, yeah, it's not really the simple meaning. I know I kind of got off the program, you know. I'm off the wagon, you know, I'm sorry about that. But the truth is, he couldn't resist because he understood as a good educator that he's not here to give you philology. He's here to educate your children and to make you into good Jews who believe in all sorts of things that he wants you to know and believe. Ibn Ezra quotes the Midrash, not because he's interested in the lens of meaning, it's an insolent lens of truth. He wants to get to the truth. So, you know why he accepts Midrash? Not because, like, well, you know, he really is a radical. He doesn't believe in any of this stuff. He believes there's some element of biblical criticism and stuff, of, you know, a verse here or there or a phrase here and there that may have come in later authorship. You know, he has all these radical kind of ideas. So you might say, oh, well, he's a radical. So he really wants to just read the text radically, but, you know, he doesn't want to get thrown out, so he claims that he believes in these rabbinic things. And what we're suggesting is, and these professors at Hebrew also affirm that. I think Uriel Simon is a religious professor of Bible. What they're claiming is that, no, he's not just apologetically accepting rabbinic ideas, not just submitting to the rabbis because, you know, they'll hit him over the head and put him in chayrim if he doesn't. He's accepting it because he believes that they also hold a certain truth. Now, he's agnostic about it. He says, look, that truth is somewhat limited. I mean, there are some things in the Talmud which go back to Moses and some that don't. So if I can, and some things I'm not sure what they are. And if I'm even not sure, I'll accept the rabbinic tradition. But if, but only when I'm sure. Only when, if I'm not sure, then I'll say that if they have a rabbinic tradition, I accept it. If I am sure that it's rabbinic tradition, I accept it. Because it's also part of the truth. As a modern Orthodox Jew, I'm using that in his day, he's a modern Orthodox Jew, he's going to use his sexual education and his rabbinic education to read that text and get to the true meaning. And those are the glasses that Ibn Ezra wears when he reads the Bible.
Thank you.
Yes?
Yeah, before you close, in light of this discussion, can you comment on the Art Scroll translation of the Song of Songs? Just put it in that perspective of what we've been discussing.
Okay, right. Right, so the Art Scroll says there's this licentious book called The Song of Songs. If you translate it literally, you have to hide it on the back shelf so you shouldn't read it. I wouldn't have an English secular book with that nature, on my shelf. And here is this book, Song of Songs, in the Bible. And if you translate it literally, you're going to have a very salacious volume on your shelf. So the Art Scroll came up with a great solution. It's a metaphor, so we'll just give you the metaphor. We're not going to tell you. We'll give you, it's a metaphor for something. We'll tell you what it's a metaphor for. We will not translate what the actual sexual imagery is. So you could say that this is a total abandonment of the Ibn Ezra. This is terrible. The Ibn Ezra is very much into the plain meaning of the text. You've got to know the plain meaning of the text. To go jump to the allegory is horrible. You could also say that the truth is that this book is not there to as aphrodisiac or something. Right? This book is here to talk about your relationship with God. And since the rabbis told us that we accept the book on that premise, so I don't even care how it was originally written for. The book is in the Bible as a image of our relationship with God. And therefore, I'm going to read it that way, and that's the truth. Then's the truth. So you can look at it both ways.
it seems to me, it's the lens of truth, that they're both looking through the same lens. It just depends how wide you want to open the lens, mm-hmm. one to the other. Same lens, but
they're both using
very wide. Yes.
They're both using the drachic lens.
Right, but one is making it more narrow. The lens opening is more narrow than the other.
In what sense is that? It's narrow because it's just... How is Rashi more narrow?
Rashi, I think, to me, there are many ways he's less narrow.
Oh, go ahead. I see. The lens of truth. Truth is what it means, period.
Right.
Rashi has a broader, juicier, more amorphous kind of reading of what the truth would be. Right. But I don't think it's... Right. Right. Of course, anyone who pursues Torah is pursuing truth. But... the Rabbi Lichtenstein gave a lecture, as usual, half of us didn't understand what he was talking about, but it's something to do with, we understood the title, which was the Torah of Chesed. That there's the Torah of truth, which we talked about tonight, the Torah of Chesed, meaning, generously speaking, the verse could mean this. A kind reading of this verse would allow for this wild interpretation. But not a simple meaning. I think we'd have to resort to that with Rashi. Yeah.
There are a lot of rabbis that really were very much opposed to Midrash. There were Zero and others that were just... rabbis were very much opposed to Midrash.
The greatest shot person is Rashbam, and he has a commentary in the Talmud. He's viewed as a major Talmudist.
Yeah.
So he has two lives. Because it was said, there are two true truths, the two readings. The rabbinic reading is rabbinic reading. You want the rabbinic reading, open the Midrash. You don't need him. And he's there to give you the simple meaning. And the way Uriel Simon developed in an article, these two truths can coexist. You can say, this is the simple meaning, and this is the Midrashic meaning. And that's what Rashi does a lot of times. He says, this is a simple meaning, and based on Midrash, it's that. We're going to see that next week as well. Ramban, simple meaning, Midrashic meaning. Mystical meaning. He's going to give you a third layer. What we're going to look at next week is the broad lens. Not so much in the mushy sense, but in the sense of so far we've been looking at words and philology and syntax. Where's the broader picture? What's the whole story about? What's the book about? What's the Torah trying to say in general? So the Ramban has a lot to say about the broader, bigger picture. So we'll see that next week. Anyway, thanks everyone for joining us.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you next time.